Well, good evening. On a pleasant rainy afternoon, I called David yesterday sometime in the middle part of the day. I think I gave him that much warning, and I said, you know, I've got so many things I've got to take care of here. Would you mind preaching for me Sunday morning, and then I'd do Sunday evening? And he was gracious enough to do that. And then this afternoon was such a beautiful rainy day for napping or sitting on the porch watching the rainfall. But anyway, that's what happens when we change things, expecting that it will help us out. Sometimes it does. Sometimes then we think other things might have helped us. But I appreciate David doing that. I did want to talk to you this evening about Samson. And, of course, Joe just read for us the last episode in Samson's life, one with which we're familiar. I'd like to begin reading the start of Samson's life there in chapter 13. Really, as much as we think about Samson, just those few chapters contain the whole of his life. You've heard the end, now hear the beginning. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now therefore be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines." Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very awesome. And I did not ask him where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. But he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now you shall not drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.' Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, 'O Lord, please let the man of God whom you have sent come to us again, that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born.'" Well, here we have the beginning of the story of Samson, and it starts with such promise, as is so often the case in the story of God's people. They are in trouble, and God begins long before the rescue to plan for that rescue, and oftentimes, as in this case, with the birth of a special child through whom he is going to work his salvation for his people. And, of course, this is one of those cases in which we are anxious to know who this child is going to be and, you know, what his future is going to be like. And, of course, we're hearing him described as being a Nazarite from the womb. He's specially to be dedicated to God. He's not to cut his hair. He's not to drink. He's not to the wine. He's not to touch the dead things. He is to be specially holy to God. And we think, you know, what a wonderful future this boy has. And of course, in some ways, he does have just such a wonderful future. But what I really want to focus on, and what you can't help but focus on when you think about Samson, is Samson's sins, because he has, in fact, such great promise, and yet there are such obvious sins in his life. There is not only the issue of the sins, but what it is that they cost him. Those are the two things I want us to think about this evening. Of course, when we start to think about Samson, it's obvious to us, first of all, as we know right away, he was the strongest man in the Bible. And, of course, that's what we always like, superlatives, and especially we like the superlative of the strongest man. Some of you perhaps have watched the strongest man competition on ESPN when nothing else sports-wise worth watching was on. And they all do all kind of Herculean sort of tasks. And yet, I think Samson probably would have been right in there with them, besting them. He seems to have had that kind of special strength that was given to him by God to do those things. And we admire that. But of course, the thing about Samson that makes him maybe more admirable was that he was a judge of Israel. He was one of those men through whom God exercised his almost direct rule over his people. And when it says that he judged Israel, it's not only that he commanded them and told them what to do. That's not quite the work of the judge. More like he advised them and he gave them the wisdom of God and told them what they should do in their personal lives as well as in their national lives. So here it is, an honorable position and an admirable position for this man. And he was a hero. I don't think there's any doubt about that as we think about Samson and the life that he lived. You know, you're familiar with the stories, I'm sure, about how he single-handedly turned back the Philistine armies, how he took the jawbone of the donkey and how he slew thousands of them. And you can just see them surrounding him like a pack of braying dogs around the lion, and yet he's shaking them off and destroying them. You remember how in that one episode he had tore the gates of the city out and took and carried them off, how he grabbed the foxes and tied them together and set firebrands in their tails and sent them out through the Philistines' wheat fields. And of course, that last heroic effort of his when he is chained and he is humiliated, and yet he calls upon the Lord in one last great burst of strength in a heroism that we have to admire. He pulls the building down, not only on his enemies, but on himself as well. Certainly those are things that we admire. And of course, you have to observe this as we looked at the beginning of his life. He has godly parents. And what a great beginning that is that we sometimes take for granted, I think. Josephus says of them, though of course he is only doing kind of hearsay reporting about that over a number of generations, but he says of them, one Manoah, a person of such virtue that he had few men his equals. And without dispute, he was the principal person of his country. And Manoah had a wife celebrated for her beauty and excelling her contemporaries. Well, that's the way they thought about them. The Bible certainly does indicate to us that his parents were in some ways admirable and gave him a good start in life. For one thing, they shared life together. And that, I think, is something that we take for granted, perhaps, as we read this chapter 13 and into the first few chapters, verses of chapter 14. We take it for granted, perhaps, if we come from a family with two parents. But it is not something to be taken for granted or to be taken lightly. You just read through chapter 13 and you see how frequently Manoah is talking to his wife, and his wife is telling Manoah about the things that she has heard and seen, and about the times it says us, 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 and about the times in which Samson goes to them, and it says he told his mother and father, he went to his mother and father, and his mother and father said to him. And you will say, of course, well, that's just accommodative language. We always say mother and father, mother, father, this, when really they may not be a perfect agreement about that. Well, of course it's accommodative, but it's accommodative for exactly that reason that we think that's the way it ought to be. We know there are occasions when husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, don't agree with one another, but they put on a united front for their children, for the sake of the world. But they do that because that's the ideal. That's the way it's supposed to be. We know that's the case. And that certainly seems to be the case here with Samson's parents, that they shared together in all that they did and certainly in all that concerned him. That has to be something valuable for him. Like John the Baptist's parents, they both seem to be, as Luke says in Luke 1 and verse 6, righteous before God, walking in the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. That's why they were chosen, especially to bear this son who would deliver Israel. And you observe, too, that they were prayerful. They have been praying, and that's when the angel of the Lord comes to them. And then they pray some more, and they pray particularly, of course, as they think about the offer that has been made to them about how they're going to take care of this child. And that's one of the wonderful things about growing up in a family, in a household, that are Christians, in which prayers are offered regularly. There's this small kind of doggerel rhyme that suggests the importance, perhaps, of overseeing and overhearing prayers daily in a household. When father prays, he doesn't use the words the preacher does. Well, of course, in our household, that's not going to happen, probably, David, because it's the same person, the preacher and the father. But there's different things for different days, but mostly it's for us. I can't remember all of it. I'm little yet, you see. But one thing I cannot forget, my father prays for me. And you think that would make a difference. And you would think that would make a difference in Samson's life as he grows up knowing that his parents are praying people and their prayers very frequently are focused on him. Because clearly they wanted to raise their child for God. That's what they ask about in Judges 13 and verse 8. Manoah entreated the Lord and said, come and help us, teach us how we should raise this boy who is to be born. Even before he was born, they had that in their mind. They wanted to know, how are we going to teach this boy and how are we going to train him? And that was the focus of their life so long as they had that child. And certainly we understand the importance of training up a child in the way he should go. And when he's old, he'll not depart from that. They were not foolish like some people who say, you know, I don't want to prejudice my children in religious matters. I want them to grow up, you know, with an open mind so when they get to be of an age, they can make a decision for themselves. Well, that's just not going to work. You might as well say, I got a garden out back and I don't want to predispose it either to weeds or to flowers or to vegetables. I'm going to leave it alone and let it make up its own mind. Well, you know exactly what's going to grow in that garden. It ain't going to be vegetables and it ain't going to be flowers. It's going to be weeds unless you cultivate it for something better than that. And of course, the sad thing is, I think in some ways, probably, despite the fact that he was a judge, that he delivered Israel, that he was of heroic proportions, and that he was of heroic lifestyle, I think in some ways, Samson's parents were probably disappointed. All parents probably are disappointed in little ways along the way, but I think in some major ways they probably were disappointed. And as far as I can see, not because of any fault of their own, like Eli, who failed to restrain the evil in the hearts of his sons and thus saw them corrupted and corrupting Israel, nor like David, who recognized that he had brought the sword into his own house by his sins. Nonetheless, they had tried. They had done the best they could, and maybe in some ways the last act by which Samson demonstrates his return to God and his return to heroic stature is also a way in which he returns to the way in which his parents had trained him. And even in his despair in the prison, that parenting has some kind of positive influence. I think that's the case. But what we really want to talk about this evening is Samson's sins. The nature of the way in which he went wrong. We think so much about the heroism, but the sins. And the first thing to observe about Samson is that he was a willful man. He wanted the Timnath woman, as we read in Judges 14, verses 1 through 4. He went down and he saw her, and she was not of the house of Israel. And he went back up to his parents, and he said, I want her. And they said, no, there are plenty of women in your own country that are better. He said, no, I want her. Go get her for me. He was stubborn, and he was willful, and he refused to listen to other people. As Isaiah 15 and verse 23 said, rebellion is like the sin of witchcraft. Stubbornness is one of those sins that God just abhors and is at the root of so much evil in the world, stubbornness and self-will. There are these passages that suggest that we ought to be careful about that. When you choose an elder, be careful, Titus says, or Paul says, writing to Titus, that you do not choose someone who is self-willed, who is unteachable. That's not the kind of person you want in the position of authority. And of course, we also read in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10 about those evil people that were spots in their love feast, as Jude says, those men who were leading people astray and devouring them. And one of the sins that we see, and probably one of the root sins, is that they were self-willed. They were stubborn people. And so it is with Samson. I saw her, I wanted her, you get her, and I don't care what you say about it. He also refused then the counsel of his parents. And of course, you wonder how much better off he would have been and what the story would have been for Israel even in his time had he listened to the counsel of his parents about that. And once you think about that, you think this thought too. Well, those of us who are older think this thought. How many young people would be better off if they listened to the counsel of their parents or the counsel of those who are older? I'm not sure whether young people think about that so very much, but that certainly is something the Bible thinks about a lot. Proverbs 13 and verse 1 points out that it is foolishness to refuse a father's discipline and not to listen to rebuke. That in fact, it is a fool, Proverbs 15 and verse 5, who rejects his father's discipline. And going on saying it's worse than that, it's dangerous. Proverbs 30 and verse 17 tells us that the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and the young eagles will eat it. You know, a lot of kids today, they think their parents scold them too much. You know, and have any of you ever had your parents tell you that the ravens are going to peck out your eyes if you don't listen to what they tell you? You know, well, we'd be horrified about that, to say that sort of thing today. We think maybe we would, you know, kind of twist their delicate little self-esteem or something. But the truth of the matter is, that's a dangerous thing, to disobey parents. And you wonder about that. When you read that finally disobedience of parents is a sin, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, the Apostle Paul talks about the dangerous times that are coming, and there are all kind of bad things listed in that long list, but one of them right in the middle is disobedient to parents. There's a root of all kinds of difficulties. And I know that sounds like, it sounds like an old fogey, I guess, to say that. And that's what's been said by old fogies in almost every generation. You can read that complaint among the Greeks, and you can read that complaint among the Romans, and you can read that complaint among the people in the medieval times, that in fact, the children just don't listen. They're disobedient. And what's this generation coming to, and how terrible it is? And of course, the consequences are very frequently dire. The Greeks are no longer with us, and the Romans are no longer with us, and none of those city-states of the medieval time are with us. It is a dangerous thing, and it is a sin to be disobedient to parents. And so it was with Samson. Maybe even worse than that, he chose evil companions. He chose those to associate with that he ought not to have. And you note, it was not just an occasional thing, it was a habit, too. Judges 14 and verse 1, he wanted this daughter of the Philistines. Judges 16 and verse 1, he went down and he saw a harlot among the Philistines. Judges 16 and verse 4, then he goes into Delilah, and you know that wasn't a good thing, just by her name. And, that's right, she's the one who gave Delilah a bad name, I guess. It is just a habit with him to associate with the wrong kinds of people. And the associating with the wrong kinds of people is going to be a bad thing. Evil companions should be resisted, the Proverbs tell us. The father who is writing in Proverbs and trying to get his child to be a spouse to the right kind of woman and a spouse to wisdom says, avoid the wrong kind of woman and avoid the wrong kind of evil companions. And when they entice you, you don't listen to them, because that's dangerous to go off that way. We ought to be careful about that. There are a lot of reasons why we should avoid evil companions. One of the things that's going to happen if you associate with bad people is that you're going to be judged by those you're associated with. Young people sometimes don't seem to understand that. They want it all to work their way in their favor and somehow. They want to dress this way, but they don't want you to suppose that that's the kind of person they are. They want to dress as if they are in rebellion against society, but they don't want you to treat them that way. They want to dress as if they're immoral, but they don't want you to treat them that way. They want to associate with these people who are evil people, who are engaged in petty theft, or maybe who are engaged in drugs, or maybe who are disrespectful, and yet they don't want you to judge them that way. But that's the way it's going to be. We are judged by the people that we associate with, because in fact, people associate with those they're comfortable with. Birds of a feather do indeed flock together. And the bad thing, too, is that, you say, it's just a temporary thing. Just right now, these are the friends of my youth. The friends of one's youth will determine who the friends of one's old age are going to be. We make lifelong friends in our early years. And worse than that, or maybe better than that, if you make the right choice, that's the group from which we're going to choose the people that become our husband or our wife. And that certainly is important. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14 reminds Christians that they ought not to be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. There are plenty of reasons to be careful about associating with those who are immoral or unrighteous or irreligious. But maybe this is the most important one of all. that we want to be careful about the lifelong connections that we make, and especially the marriages that we make. And we also recognize that when we spend time with evil companions, we become like them. There's not going to be any doubt about that. You may say, I am not like them. I'm going to have a good influence on them. But evil is like leaven, we're told in 1 Corinthians 5. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And if you associate with and spend your time with people who are immoral, then that's the kind of person that you're going to be. I'm not sure what Samson's reasoning was about all of that. He may have thought, I'm going down and ferret out their secrets. I'm going to make some connections with them that I can use so I can influence them for good, so that, they'll take it easy on the Israelites, on my people. I'm not sure what his reasoning was. I'm not even sure he reasoned about it. He probably rationalized about it when folks asked him why he was doing that or criticized him for doing that. I'm not sure he reasoned about it at all. That's generally the way it is. Be careful about the people you associate with. And, of course, evil companions corrupt good morals. We become involved and immersed in those activities. That's the way we see life. That's the kind of person that we become. Isn't that amazing? That we are like the people that we're with. We spend our time with them. And it's not because we're hypocrites or chameleons and just take it on, temporarily here or temporarily there. There are some people like that, I suppose. But you spend time with people, you learn how they think, and you start to think as they think. You get used to the ways they conduct themselves, and those are the things that you do. Avoid evil companions. Another of the sins of Samson was that he gave in instead of persisting. He should have resisted longer than he did in having these various temptations presented to him. Of course, the truth of the matter is you recognize that it was a nagging woman that he finally gave in to. It was Delilah who kept after him. And, I read that story over and over. He tells her, if you bind me with new ropes, I'll lose my strength. And he wakes up and he's bound with new ropes. If you weave my hair into a loom, then I'll lose my strength. He wakes up and lo and behold, his hair's all tangled up. You'd think he would figure it out after a while. But then it says it came about she pressed him daily with her words and urged him, and his soul was annoyed to death. Annoyed to death. That's an amazing thing, that you can just be nagged to the point that you would lose your good sense. The Bible, of course, warns us that nagging women are indeed a weariness. The contentions of a wife are like a continual dropping. It's not powerful, but it is persistent and it is continuous and it goes on and on and on and on. I don't know anything about it, obviously. I married a wife that is nice to me, more than I deserve. But it apparently is a terrible, bad thing. Know where the word nagging comes from? Nagging comes from a Scandinavian word when they had all the rats running all over the place that brought the bubonic plague with all the fleas that were on them. And they were in all the houses and in all the buildings. And at night when the lights went out, and of course they didn't have electric lights, you could hear them. Noggin and noggin and noggin and noggin all over the house and all over the city. And you could hear them noggin. And so that's what they likened the nagging to, that noggin all night long. And of course, he's just couldn't. I have tinnitus, they call it, I guess, the ringing in the ears. I had it for years before I figured it out. And we go to bed at night and I could hear it. And I thought it was bugs in the walls. I thought it was termites, and I'd get up and I'd search around, but it wasn't termites, fortunately. We did have termites after a while, but it wasn't what I was hearing, apparently. But, you just couldn't stand it. They're all over, everywhere. Well, I can understand that, Samson, but you should have learned that lesson before about your companions. Don't spend your time with these nagging women. Of course, nagging women are about one thing, The devil has to be resisted. You just cannot give in to Satan. You need to get yourself out of there somehow. Resist Satan. You got to say no to Satan. You can't maybe to Satan. You can't just put it off, wait a little longer, sooner or later. No, you have to resist Satan. That's what Samson should have learned, and that was his sin. Instead of resisting, however, he courted temptation. And of course, the idea of courting, that's a metaphor, you know, like courting a woman. And of course, that was a part of his temptation. Some people court other kinds of temptations in exactly the same kind of nearly romantic, fanciful sort of way. But he courted temptations. He went back again and again and again. Instead of fleeing from youthful lust, as Paul advised Timothy, no, he went back over and over again. He made friends with sin. He surrounded himself by sinful people when he should have been fleeing the other way. Flee. You know, you think about Joseph and how he ran away from Potiphar's wife. And fleeing doesn't seem so very manly or so very heroic. It seems rather cowardly, perhaps. But that's exactly the attitude we ought to have about the fearsomeness of sin and temptation, particularly the temptation that is most attractive to us. You know, not everybody's equally attracted to each kind of temptation. We have our own special kind of temptation, and we ought to know what that is and know how dangerous it is and flee from it with everything that is in us, just like we'd flee from a poisonous snake or just like we'd flee from a ravenous lion. Well, that's exactly the image the Bible uses, isn't it? A ravenous, roaring lion. They opened up the new Jungala over at Busch Gardens. Of course, my wife had to go over because she loves the kitties. But Lydia was with her, and she said, they're not really, you know, you're glad there's, you wish there were thicker glass sometimes between you and them. Fearful things. And just as you'd run from those, you should run from temptation. Don't be out courting temptation. And of course, he committed fornication. He went to that harlot, and he knew her. Committed fornication. And we may think sometimes, you know, that's one of the big sins. You know, that's one of the things that we're not going to be bothered with. We worry about refining, you know, the tongue and refining our love and controlling our temper and those kinds of things. And that's not something that we would ever commit, fornication. I'm not sure how Samson thought about that either, but you don't usually think about a judge of Israel committing those kinds of sin, a Nazarite from his birth committing those kinds of sins. And the truth of the matter is, some are caught in those kinds of sins because they run straight toward them. There are some who are caught in those kinds of sins because they court around the edge of it, because they kind of like it and they attracted by it, and they never would do it, but, you know, they know that they're tempted by that. And there are others, young people among the church, who are caught in that trap, not because they've courted it in the sense of wanting that and desiring it and thinking about it, but because of their naivete and their innocence, perhaps. And they think, that would never happen to us. We're Christians. That couldn't happen to us. But spending too much time alone with nothing else to do is a bad thing. And there are plenty who are caught in this sin, this very sin of fornication that Samson committed. Be careful about all of these sins. That's, I think, the lesson we learn, particularly from Samson. And he gave up the source of his strength. He gave up the source of his strength when he told Delilah about his hair. And then he woke up and all his hair had been shaved off and his strength was gone. And of course, it wasn't the hair, was it? It wasn't the hair that gave him the strength. It was the God who had commanded him not to cut his hair who gave him the strength. And I think Samson probably knew that. I don't think he was so foolish as to think it was just the hair, and if he grew the hair back, no, he had to grow back the relationship with God and trust on God again. There are people, perhaps, who think today, you know, they grow their hair out, they'd be, you know, strong, I suppose. But we're not even talking about that kind of strength. We're talking about the kind of strength that God wants us to have, the kind of strength that we have of the Spirit, the kind of strength we have to resist temptation. And that kind of strength comes from the very same source that Samson got his strength, having a right relationship with God. And he gave that up. Having his hair shaved because he told that to Delilah is just the last straw. I mean, I think he knew. Surely he knew she was going to shave his hair, didn't he? I mean, he wasn't that foolish, was he? I just can't believe he didn't know that was going to happen. But he was willing somehow for it to happen. And because he was willing for it to happen, he loved her or what she represented more than he loved God. And he knew that relationship was over. He gave up the source of his strength by trusting her or by telling her those things. God wants us to be strong. He wants us to be strong, not physically, but he wants us to be strong in the Lord. He wants us to be able to stand fast and to fight manfully onward and all of those kinds of images in the battle against sin and the battle for the gospel. And our source of strength is exactly the same source of strength that Samson found his strength, and that is with God. And then finally, he was disloyal to his vows. They started even before he was born. Said that he needed to live a life in which he didn't drink wine, in which he didn't touch dead bodies, and in which he didn't shave his head or even cut his hair. As a Nazarite, those are the three main vows, apparently, although they represent the idea of serving God and being holy. And the problem, of course, we can see that he clearly was disloyal to the first two of those. It's obvious that he had his hair cut. It's obvious, too, that he touched dead bodies, had he not, when he killed the lion and then he went back by and the bees had built a hive in there and there was honey and he scraped the honey out. He had to have touched the dead carcass. He grabbed up the dead bone of the jaw of that donkey and used it as a weapon. And of course, there are all kind of overlays of images here. It seemed handy. It seemed like the only weapon, but he violated his vow to do that. Surely if he had trusted God, God would have provided some other weapon for him. He had broken those. And, you know, I don't read about him drinking wine. I don't know. Maybe his association with the Philistines and associating with harlots, maybe that's an indication of that. But I can reason very well, because I've seen it happen before, that people, you know, they committed this sin or that sin or the other. They weren't faithful to their promise here, there, or the other, but they focus on this. You know, at least I didn't drink wine. You know, I've never drank wine, Lord. I've kept that vow, but the truth of the matter is, no matter how many of those vows he'd kept, when he violated the one, that discounted the others, the keeping of the others. That's the way it is even today. There are plenty of people who will say, well, look what I have done, Lord. You know, look at my doctrinal purity. Look at the way in which I have defeated the false teachers. And yet, they have trouble in their own life. They have trouble in their own family. They have other kinds of vows to God that they have violated. You know, it's interesting. The very last thing that Joe read to us was about how he had judged Israel for 20 years. And you wonder, you know, three chapters here, and we know about the occasion of the prophecy of his birth, great detail. We know about that wedding feast. We know about a couple of the conflicts he had with the Philistines personally. We know about the end. What about those 20 years when he judged Israel? 20 years. How many judgments, how many pieces of advice did he give? How many times successfully did he point people in the right direction and steer them away from the wrong? How much good did he do in 20 years of judging Israel? And yet there's silence about that. Because in some ways it's all invalidated by the evil associations and invalidated by the sins that he committed. You know, and you wonder about how prosperous the people were during that period of time. They were still afflicted by the Philistines even after 20 years of Samson's rule. And of course, you'll remember the prophecy was that he was the one through whom God was going to begin the deliverance of his people. I don't know how much further God would have extended that deliverance of his people from the Philistines had Samson been a more willing participant in that, had he been more faithful. But you know, it just doesn't seem like they had benefited very much. The judge, the head, was not what he ought to be, and the rest of the nation wasn't either. The old proverb says that the fish rots from the head down, and they couldn't be any better, I think, than those who were their leaders, the judge. It's kind of sad to think about that. 20 years of leadership, a long period of time, and the Bible gives us no account of the success of that period of time, probably because of these sins. These are the sins of Samson. So quickly, what Samson's sins cost him? Obviously, it cost him his strength. Sin, indeed, will cost us our strength and weaken us. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 30, "For this cause many are weak and sickly among you, and many sleep." And though that may have been talking about a period of time in which there was some miraculous judgment upon them, I think it's clear, too, that any sin weakens us when we face other temptations. Any sin weakens our influence for good. Any sin that we know we've committed and we have not repented of certainly breaks our relationship with God and weakens us. He lost his sight, obviously, and sin blinds us as well. There's so many of those occasions in the Scripture when we talk about how sin is like blindness. The God of this world has blinded the minds of some of those. In Revelation 3 and verse 17, they think they can see, but they're blind and they're naked. In 2 Peter 1 verse 5 and 9, he says we ought to add all of these virtues. And if we do, then we won't be blind and short-sighted. The implication, of course, that if you don't have those virtues, if you don't have those kind of qualities in your life, then you are going to be blind and short-sighted. Sin will blind us. You know, talk about many of the things about that, how you talk to people who are sinners and they just don't see it. They just don't understand the consequences, the danger that they're in. They don't see the end result in their life, and they don't see the end result in the life to come, and they don't want to see it. They can't afford to see it because of their sins. They're blind and will not see. It cost him his freedom as he was bound and chained, and that's true. Sin enslaves. We are the slaves of those to whom we give ourselves to serve. Of course, Paul offers us an alternative here. We can be enslaved to God and to good things as surely as we can be enslaved to sin. Of course, being enslaved to sin leads to death. He lost his family and his friends, and indeed sin does divide us one from another. Divides us from God, and it divides us from all things that are good and all people that are good. The flesh is set against the spirit, Paul tells us in Galatians 5, and we better be careful about which side we're on. Choosing sin is in some ways going to make you an opponent of God. It's going to make you an enemy of the church. It's going to make you an enemy of those people who love the good and hate the evil. He lost his self-respect. Sin disgraces people. You know, we don't see that at the very beginning. What you see at the beginning are people who are high-minded and haughty and proud, and they convince themselves of the narrow-mindedness or the triviality of the rules of the church and the lives that Christians live. But in the end, they're going to be brought to disgrace. It may take them a while. Satan may use them as tempting targets or allurements for others, but ultimately sin disgraces. You think about Samson. Here he was, a judge of the nation of Israel, a hero, the strongest man of all, and they bring him out and make a mockery of him. They spit on him. The small children throw stones at him. He's blind. He is chained. He is humbled. He is disgraced. And that's certainly the case of all of those who are sinners, that they ultimately are brought to disgrace, not just in the eyes of God and of those who are righteous, but ultimately they will be brought face to face with their own weakness and with their own disgrace. He lost his life, ultimately. Of course, we all will die, but it is sin that kills, and it's sin that brought about his death in that way. The wages of sin are death, and it is impossible to escape it. The sting of death is sin. Ultimately, there would have been no death except for sin. Yet the very sad thing about it is that sin now brings about something worse than the death of the body. It brings about the second death, in which we are brought to that flaming pit that was created not for man, but for the devil and his angels. Sin killed Samson, and sin will kill us if we don't find some solution to that. And of course, we must remember Samson's sins and what they cost him. Look at that list and think to yourself, are those the kind of things that we have chosen in our life? Not that we jump wholeheartedly into those things, you know, just nibble around the edges headed in those directions. Samson's sins cost him, and they will cost us as well. But there is a solution, of course, to sin, and that solution is to be found in Jesus Christ, who paid the price for our sins and for all those who are willing to lean on Him, to reject the sins of their life, to renounce those, and to cling to the morality that He has called us to. His blood then will make the sacrifice for our sins. If you're here this evening and you have sins that need to be washed away, then you need to come to Jesus Christ, confessing that He's the Christ, the Son of the living God, be baptized for the remission of them. If you're a Christian and you have sins in your life that are not yet forgiven, you need to look in your heart to reject them, to repent of them, and to pray to God, and He will, through Jesus Christ, forgive you. If you have need, then we'd suggest you come while we stand and sing this song.